This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It may get hotter where you are sooner than you think. New science reveals many parts of the world won't have to wait long to experience unsafe heating and disruptive changes in precipitation. Once again, we underestimate the climate threat. Dr. Andy J. Pittman is a British atmospheric scientist. Now he's the director of Australia's ARC Center of Excellence for Climate System Science at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Pittman is co-author of a new piece in the journal Nature titled Allowable CO2 Emissions Based on Regional and Impact-Related Climate Targets. We'll see what that means. Andy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Okay, 2 degrees C of warming was supposed to be the safe line. Now it's not. But Andy, part of the world has already gone past 2 degrees C of warming, or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Where is that?
First of all, the 2 degrees being safe, it has never been a scientific target, as far as I know. It's always been a target agreed politically as something that's actually achievable. So for 2 degrees in the global mean warming, we would obviously anticipate major changes in climate, because we're observing major changes in climate for a global mean warming of less than 1 degree. And if we're seeing substantial changes in climate for less than 1 degree, it's a bit difficult to argue that 2 degrees is somehow safe. So first of all, 2 degrees isn't a target that I think is safe, but it's much safer than 3 degrees. But a 2 degree increase in the mean obviously isn't a 2 degree increase in every single place on Earth. There is a very strong regional differentiation in how that global 2 degrees is made up. And on average, you would expect certain regions to warm by more and certain regions to warm by less. For example, the oceans have phenomenal inertia. They warm up more slowly than the land. So immediately you should be able to imagine that for a 2 degree global mean, you would expect the continental surfaces to warm by more than the ocean surfaces. Once you take the continental surfaces into account, then you're looking for places where there are feedbacks that would amplify the local warming. There's two particular things that one can imagine in the shorter term. One is where there is snow cover and that snow is melted earlier or never accumulates because of the warming, you get the well-known snow albedo feedback, where less snow means a darker surface that absorbs more radiation and gives you a stronger warming signal because there are mechanisms operating as a positive or a amplifying feedback on the warming in general. And the other classic example is a place where traditionally there's been quite a lot of soil moisture that tends to mean that the available energy is used for evaporative cooling. If those soils dry out, you don't get the evaporation. You instead exchange energy more as what's called sensible heat, which tends to amplify the warming. You can imagine for a global warming of 2 degrees, you would expect amplification over the continents and further amplification in particular regions where these important feedbacks can dominate the radiative forcing caused by elevated carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases.
All right. Now, we know the Arctic is quite a bit warmer than it used to be, and right about as we're doing this interview, it's incredibly warm. Do you worry about rising methane emissions in the Arctic, and should we take that as seriously as we do carbon dioxide?
One of the key things about our paper is that we expect there's a reasonable chance that most of the key tipping points are not likely to be exceeded for a regional warming of 2 degrees. We're not sure about that. It's not a certainty statement. It's a probability statement. So we think a lot of the tipping points are probably stable enough that if the local temperatures warm by 2 degrees, it's unlikely those tipping points would be triggered. However, we're seeing much, much more warming than 2 degrees over certain regions, one of which, as you point out, is the Arctic, for the reasons in part to do with the snow albedo feedback I talked about a few months ago. So for a global mean warming of 2 degrees, we're looking at warming of maybe 6 or 8 degrees over the Arctic. I think the probability of those tipping points being triggered with warming of 8 degrees is extremely likely. One of those key tipping points is the destabilization of the Arctic permafrost. When you melt the permafrost, you release the gases stored, and you also accelerate the rate of microbial activity in the soils. That tends to lead to very large releases in methane. And so one of my deep concerns is that for a global mean warming of 2 degrees, brackets a regional warming over the Arctic of 6 to 8 degrees, the tipping points that we're fearful of would indeed be triggered, leading to much larger releases in methane in those regions. And that is why I'm not at all confident that we will be able to limit warming to 2 degrees, because the so-called emission scenarios that enable the global mean temperature to be limited to 2 degrees don't take into account destabilization of some of the natural sinks and stores for carbon dioxide and methane. And I think we're going to destabilize those stores, and are in fact destabilizing those stores with 1 degree of warming. And therefore, it's very unlikely that somehow they'll remain stable as we go to 2 degrees in the global mean, given the new evidence that 2 degrees in the global mean means 6 degrees in the Arctic.
All right. Now, a decade ago, regional climate predictions were pretty hazy. How did your team manage to nail down the climate trajectory on a more local level?
We looked at all of the available climate models, and we didn't attempt to say this is what the warming will be. We looked at the range in warming that you obtain across all of the models, and we looked to see where the models were confident in that and where they were less confident. And obviously the climate models are more confident where the forcing is strongest. And because of the ice albedo feedback, I think the changes in the high latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere are areas we have considerable confidence over. I think we have less confidence over some of the changes that might take place in the tropics. And although it may not interest most of your listeners, one of the really interesting results we found is considerable uncertainty in the Southern Hemisphere. And we suspect that's because I suspect that's because some of the model development that's been done internationally has lacked particular focus on the Southern Hemisphere, because most of the modeling groups are in the Northern Hemisphere. So it all depends on where you're talking about. I think the very large amplification in the Arctic and some of the temperate zones is quite reasonably reliable. But even if it's not, it points to a risk. And I'd like people to stop thinking about what we know for sure and start thinking about where risks are emerging, because in any other field, such as business, one develops one's business with a good understanding of risk, and one thinks about how to avoid those particular risks and minimize your vulnerability to external factors. And I think in climate science, we need to do very much the same in how we deal with global warming. We need to stop worrying about are we sure about something, and be much clearer that what the models are telling us about are emerging risks, and those need to be managed in the same way as they would be managed in any other field.
I think that's a great point. I think you've just taught me something more. Well, let's get specific. Let's talk about one region in your study which will warm 2 degrees or more by 2030, which is only 15 years away. Why don't we start with your findings on the Mediterranean countries?
Sort of builds on your earlier question. The Mediterranean is one of the places where there is extremely consistent results from the climate models. And I think the reason for that is to do with the particular synoptic situation that the Mediterranean finds itself in, and that it's warming due to the overall greenhouse effect. But there's also a soil moisture signal there, that you dry the Mediterranean even drier than it traditionally is. And as you dry the area, you reduce evaporation and you increase the direct heating from the land via the sensible heat fluxes. And that amplifies the overall pattern of warming before, for instance, 2 degrees. So we're not the first to draw attention to the Mediterranean. Many groups around the world have identified the Mediterranean as a particularly vulnerable region and a region that's particularly sensitive to mean warming. So in that sense, our results really for the Mediterranean are largely confirming results that are being found by earlier groups.
So what does overheating in the Mediterranean or other regions that you've identified tell us about the limits we need to set on global emissions?
So there is a so-called global emission limit of 1,000 billion tons, which has been talked about, and it was talked about in the last Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. A very important thing about that is that that 1,000 billion tons assumes no destabilization of natural stores of carbon or methane. And as I said earlier, I think that's incompatible with how we understand the Earth system to work. Taking it beyond that argument, if you want to avoid warming a region by more than 2 degrees, and we're able to show that for a global mean warming of 2 degrees, a particular region might warm by 4 degrees, it obviously means that you have to reduce the allowable emissions globally to substantially below 2 degrees. And that, I fear, is emerging from a lot of studies now, that 2 degrees isn't safe because a 2 degree warming is expressed over the land surface by warming of much more than 2 degrees. And it's not expressed as a sort of a regional average warming of 2 degrees. It's expressed, for instance, by earlier spring heat waves, or the ability of a landscape to continue to grow through a winter because the winter is several degrees warmer than it used to be, or it's expressed by summer heat waves lasting longer. And as your listeners would know, if you have a heat wave that traditionally lasts 3 days and it starts to last 5 days, the impacts that has on ecosystems, but also primarily on human health, can be way out of proportion to only an extra day or two. An important thing about our paper is not that if the globe warms by 2 degrees, the Mediterranean might warm by 4 degrees. It's how that warming takes place. And it isn't just everywhere gets a little bit warmer through the year. That warming tends to be concentrated in particular periods, and that can have profound impacts on human populations, but also a range of other socio-environmental factors.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. We're joined by atmospheric scientist Dr. Andy J. Pittman. I think the other startling result in this paper is the timing of climate impacts. We're used to reports talking about things happening by 2100, frankly, after we're dead. Now science has shortened that fuse. Serious impacts may be less than 15 years away. Did that surprise your team?
Not particularly, because whilst you're absolutely right in how you introduced that question, the climate scientists have been drawing attention to extreme events, which can in part be attributable to global warming, having occurred over the last few decades. So we are observing extreme events that can either be explained by global warming or have been amplified by global warming, or their probability has been increased by global warming over the last couple of decades. Now, if we have been observing very large changes in extreme events over the last decade, it's hardly surprising that we'll see that over the next couple of decades as warming intensifies. So I think our results aren't particularly surprising in that regard. I do think it's helpful to draw attention to the 2030s, because it's obviously in the sort of timescales people plan for with infrastructure and a range of other things. But I don't want your listeners to think about global warming as a future impact. Anyone who works in climate science knows that we have been observing substantial changes over the last few decades, and indeed groups in ecology, groups in oceanography, groups in glacial sciences, and people working in areas of human health have clearly identified changes in the systems they're familiar with as a consequence of the observed changes to date. So think of global warming as a clear and present danger, not as something that we should be worried about evolving by 2030, for instance.
I have to ask you, though, for those countries that aren't going to warm faster, I mean, in Canada, people might welcome some warming. Do we need to worry less about climate change then, since it's not going to affect our country that fast?
If the warming was sort of a little warming on each day of the year, my experience of Canada, which have always been fantastic, suggests that that wouldn't be in any sense catastrophic. But it ain't like that. That's not how warming happens. If you manage to warm a region of eastern or western Canada by 3 degrees on the annual average, but all that warming happens in July, the amount it warms in July is vastly more than 3 degrees, and you start to get serious heat wave conditions. Now, I remember summers in Toronto being really quite hot, and you don't necessarily want to start experiencing extreme heat wave conditions in Canada. For a start, it triggers extraordinary vulnerability around forest fires. It also tends to trigger ecological changes, which can weaken ecosystems, which makes them much more vulnerable to fire. It can have profound impacts if the heat wave conditions occur at the wrong timing of the phenology of your wheat production, for example. So it sounds quite attractive in one sense if you do warm a region by a couple of degrees, but that isn't how it works. That warming would tend to be concentrated in relatively short periods, be a lot more than a couple of degrees, and if your systems have been built or your farming practices have been built with a certain climate in mind, and you start getting events well outside the observed range, it can have really major impacts on your economy, on your ecology, and on your populations. So no, I don't think it's a good news story for Canada. If we were able to warm your winter by a couple of degrees, that might sound like a good idea, but I don't think that's how things will actually eventuate.
All right. Given that, what further science do we need, and what are the limits to how small you think we can go with these predictions?
The major science that's necessary is perhaps not that important. And as a scientist, arguing that we don't need more science is not a particularly common narrative. It is very attractive for the climate science community to be able to build better models informed by better data, finessing the spatial detail at much higher resolution. So there have been calls, which I would strongly support, for instance, of being able to get the climate models down to, say, a 20-kilometer spatial resolution, so that there's certain characteristics of the atmosphere that we would begin to capture much more explicitly, and I think we'd build better predictive skill and a whole range of things like that. But the main message from our paper is that we have probably erred too generously on the emissions that have been discussed across the global community, and we have probably erred as a science community in being a little conservative in how fast climate can change, and we have also had our eye on the averages more so than the extremes. Now, that's a general statement. There are some outstanding groups in North America and in Europe that have focused on extremes. But in general, the climate community has been really interested in how much will the global average warm. And I think what our paper says is it doesn't matter really what the global average warms. It matters critically on how climate warms spatially by country and how that warming is translated into days of heat or cold or days of extreme rainfall, because those are the things that can break a drainage system, break a health system, damage an ecosystem. So most of what I think our paper is about is a call to indicate that we have been too generous on the scale of emissions that should be permitted. But if I was going to take the science further, I would encourage the research communities to be targeting the nature and the statistics of extreme events into the future over how much the planet as a whole will warm.
Please tell us about the lead author of this paper.
Sonia Senaratne, she's a professor at ETH in Zurich. She has a long, quite phenomenal career in climate science. She was the lead author, for instance, on what's called the SREX report, which you can Google, which is our state-of-the-art knowledge of how extremes exist and occur within the climate system.
Is there anything else that I've missed that you would like to tell our listeners?
I think, really, just to sum up, what our paper has highlighted about how extremes will change at regional scales, that it's not just the average that matters, and it's how those extremes will change by region or by country that's very important. And I'm hoping that one of the things that will flow from this is that countries will begin to do a systematic assessment of their vulnerability to significantly more warming than they have assumed with the 2 degrees. So if countries have been looking at their vulnerability to 2 degrees of warming, they're missing the point. They need to know what their country will warm by, and they then need to look at the systems within that country and see whether their systems are resilient to warming of 3, 4, 5 degrees. And if a country like Canada can demonstrate it's resilient to warming in certain periods of the year of 4 degrees or 5 degrees, well, you may have some time to build improved socioeconomic and environmental systems to withstand additional warming. But my guess is that most countries will discover that they are extremely vulnerable economically and environmentally and socially to the sorts of regional scale warmings that we describe in this paper. And perhaps it's a bit of a wake-up call that 2 degrees ain't safe, and many of our countries are more vulnerable to global warming than the public have generally assumed.
Dr. Andy J. Pittman is the director of Australia's ARC Centre of Excellence for Climate System Science. He's at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. You can find out more information on all of this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Andy, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.